Afraid for Your Life in Kenya, today on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. President Obama speaks up for gay rights before arriving in Kenya. Homosexuality is illegal there, as this openly gay Kenyan knows all too well.
Some of us, like I myself, will be arrested, and the treatment we'll be subjected to is cruel and degrading. It is absolutely untenable when it comes to humanity and how you treat another human being.
Then Obama goes to Ethiopia, and he's under pressure to talk about human rights there. This Ethiopian-American isn't sure what to expect.
There's the Iran nuclear deal. There's opening relations with Cuba. For me, I don't know what will come from this trip. I think Obama has a lot of space to surprise us.
It's all coming up here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's been a long time coming, 6.5 years to be precise. Today, Barack Obama finally arrived in Kenya for his first visit there as president. Obama's late father was from Kenya, so people there consider the president one of their own. But not all Kenyans will be thrilled with what President Obama has to say. He's promised to speak up for gay rights in Kenya, where homosexuality is illegal and discrimination against gay people is widespread. Here's what the president told the BBC ahead of his visit.
Everybody deserves fair treatment, equal treatment in the eyes of the law and the state. And that includes gays, lesbians, transgender persons. I am not a fan of discrimination and bullying of anybody on the basis of race, on the basis of religion, on the basis of sexual orientation or gender.
Strong words, but is Kenya listening? Eric Gatari hopes so. He's the executive director of Kenya's National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. He joins me now from Nairobi. Eric Gatari, is this what you wanted to hear from President Obama?
It sounds more like what we want to hear from him as he arrives today, and we hope that he'll be consistent in that message with whatever spaces he'll be speaking in, whether with the president or with the public.
What is the position of the Kenyan government on homosexuality? And as a gay man, how are you treated?
We are using a penal code of 1963, which was borrowed from the British government as early as 1897. And what this law says is that anyone who has gained knowledge against the order of nature is guilty of a felony and is supposed to go to jail upon a finding of guilt for 14 years. Just last year, the government produced statistics in Parliament showing that between 2010 and 2014, they had prosecuted 595 cases of homosexuality in the criminal justice system. The recent case that we know of is in February this year, where two young men were arrested in a public restaurant and they were held for 4 days in a police custody. And when they were presented before court, the court ordered that they be taken through anal examination to prove that they had consensual adult sex in private.
Now, Eric, the language that you talked about there, carnal knowledge against nature, I mean, isn't actually that shocking in America, because we've had laws like that on the books for a long time until very recently. But the punishment is really shocking, 14 years in jail. I mean, especially considering America now has gay marriage allowed in every state.
It's absolutely shocking, but we must also be aware of another law, which is a recent law, and it says that any adult who has indecent acts with another adult, they're supposed to go to jail for 5 years. And indecent acts with an adult could be touching hands or kissing, and indecency is subject to the reasonable opinion of anyone in public.
Eric, is this something you feel every day, the sort of threat hanging over your head?
Sometimes we walk around knowing that, especially because of the recent arrest that happened this year in February, where people are simply suspected of being gay. If you look at the medical records as to why they were subjected through anal testing, the reason was simply they were suspected of being gay. So some of us walk around fearing that should there be any political pressure to arrest persons who've come out as gay, some of us, like I myself, will be arrested, and the treatment we'll be subjected to is cruel and degrading. You know, testing and forced HIV testing to prove that you're homosexual. It is absolutely untenable when it comes to humanity and how you treat another human being. I went to this barbershop in Nairobi, and I wanted to get my hair cut, but the barber there told me that I could not receive service because some of the patrons in the barbershop had seen me on television advocating for gay rights, and they were concerned about their association with a known homosexual. I have been denied entry to social premises such as restaurants and bars, and the usual rhetoric that I am told is that people like you are not allowed here. I am lucky to have a landlady who understands me, and she's not evicted me to the present, notwithstanding the fact that we've had a conversation about my orientation. I would say I am lucky to not have gone through experiences of violence to a scale that is physical.
Eric, I wonder, just as a Kenyan, how do you feel, you know, about the president coming to visit, but it took him 6.5 years to do that?
He made a promise, and he's keeping his word. Best we say is a bit later than never. The very conviction and anchor that he had for running for presidency, the ideals of social democracy and the equality that he ran with, we are looking forward to feeling that effect here. I remember when he was in Kenya last time as a senator, I attended his lecture at the University of Nairobi as a law student there, and I was very, very much inspired. I look at him today, and a lot of Kenyans look at him today as a man who's journeyed through a lot of hardship to a point of great success. He stands as a man who inspires a lot of hope in a lot of young men and young women and others in this country that they can make it.
Eric Gatari is executive director of Kenya's National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. President Obama's second stop on this trip will be in Ethiopia. He travels to Addis Ababa on Sunday. There, Obama will address the African Union, which has its headquarters in Addis. The president's decision to visit Ethiopia, though, has sparked some criticism. Jeffrey Smith is an Africa specialist at the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. And Jeffrey, you've written in Foreign Policy these words. "Let's be clear," you write, "Ethiopia is not a model of democracy that should be rewarded with a presidential visit." But, you know, the African Union is headquartered there. Isn't that where he needs to go?
Sure, you're right. The African Union is headquartered in the capital of Ethiopia. And I think on the positive side, you know, there is undoubtedly a longstanding bilateral relationship between the United States and Ethiopia. There are many shared interests, including promoting and maintaining regional stability, facilitating peace in a very troublesome context in South Sudan, countering al-Shabaab in Somalia and Kenya as well, which is a real and ongoing threat. And let's face it, advancing Ethiopia's own growth and development, which has been rather modest and at times impressive over the past decade.
So you just blew your entire article out of the water right there.
Let's be clear. There are, of course, laudable goals that should be actively pursued by the U.S. government. However, once you start to peel back the layers of Ethiopia, you soon realize that Ethiopia has become a pioneering model for political repression in sub-Saharan Africa through a range of draconian laws that have stifled the opposition, that have decimated civil society. And these laws, more troublingly, have been copied and pasted and implemented elsewhere throughout sub-Saharan Africa.
So is the problem then really President Obama's visit, or that the African Union is headquartered there?
The problem is with the message that President Obama's visit to Ethiopia sends. What many people don't know is Ethiopia is actually the fourth most censored country in the world. And to give just a brief snapshot, in the past year alone, 6 independent publications have been shut down. Along with that, a very troubling sign was the fact that on June 19, when this trip by the Obama administration was announced, 3 high-profile opposition political members in Ethiopia were murdered under very mysterious circumstances that have yet to be properly investigated.
But can't moments like these actually be helpful, where the president can call attention to what's going on?
Sure. Well, first off, I'm very pleased to hear that on Tuesday, the president will participate in a civil society roundtable that will include human rights activists from Ethiopia. But again, despite the obvious lack of political rights and civil liberties in Ethiopia, unfortunately, the prime minister of Ethiopia is palatable to Washington precisely because who he is not because of who he is. He's not a retrograde dictator in the mold of some of his regional counterparts. We already mentioned Eritrea or Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, who is currently indicted by the ICC.
Well, the president has promised to speak bluntly against corruption and human rights violations. I wonder first, do you trust that he will do that? And if he does, what impact could that have?
Clearly, in Ethiopia and elsewhere, there needs to be legal reforms that allow for the free flow of goods, the free flow of services, greater transparency, and anti-corruption measures. That's number one. We have to take advantage of the fact that sub-Saharan Africa's economy in general has doubled in size over the past 15 years to $1 trillion, which is a remarkable opportunity for the continent, but also for the United States, which has really been lagging behind China, for instance. If you look at U.S. imports to Africa, they amount to less than 5% of China's imports to Africa. And also, most importantly, it's simply not enough to speak, even if forcefully or compellingly, about the need to protect human rights. There needs to be concrete action, and that is clearly not happening. Again, if you go back to the president's speech in Ghana in 2009, where he repeatedly said that there was a need for strong democratic institutions, not strong men in Africa. This visit and this visit to Ethiopia really seems to stand at odds with that message.
Jeffrey Smith is an Africa specialist at the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights in Washington, D.C. Thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So President Obama's headed for Addis Ababa on Sunday. Can you find that on a map? Try out our mapping quiz at PRI.org. If you land closer than 1,000 miles, you're a better geographer than I am. Yep, I was way off. And we have a big map here on the wall. Don't get all smug, though. You give it a go at PRI.org. Coming up later, by the way, we'll hear from San Francisco-based Ethiopian singer Maklit Hadero. So stay tuned for that. And before we take a short break, here's a quick note on doping in sports. No, it's not another story on cyclists at the Tour de France using EPO or sluggers taking steroids. I'm talking about the use of performance-enhancing drugs in professional computer gaming, also known as esports.
In esports, sometimes a split second can be all the difference in winning $100,000 or maybe zero.
That's James Lampkin. He's a vice president with the Electronic Sports League, or ESL. It's the world's largest professional esports league, with more than 5 million registered players. Each month, he says, players from across the globe gather at ESL tournaments, where they compete for hundreds of thousands of dollars in prize money.
It's very high pressure. The stakes are getting higher and higher. And just like in some traditional sports, some pro gamers are beginning to look for that extra edge.
And that extra edge means using performance-enhancing drugs.
So the number one drug we're seeing right now is the use of amphetamines, like Adderall, like Ritalin, which are traditionally prescribed by doctors to help with ADHD. These drugs are banned by all international athletic organizations. So these are drugs that we think some players may be trying to take off some of the edge.
Last week, a pro gamer seemed to admit in a YouTube video that he and his team used Adderall at a tournament back in March. The ESL already bans the use of such drugs, but starting next month at a tournament in Cologne, Germany, officials will begin randomly testing competitors. The Electronic Sports League also says it's working with both national and international anti-doping agencies on the problem. Coming up, how Donald Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric is going down south of the border. That's just ahead here on The World.
The World is supported by LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're with The World. Malaria kills hundreds of thousands of people each year, mostly children in sub-Saharan Africa. And despite decades of research, a vaccine against the disease has been elusive. Now, finally, European regulators have recommended one for approval, even though it's far from perfect. The vaccine, called Mosquirix, was developed by British pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, working with the PATH Malaria Vaccine Initiative. David Caslow is Vice President for Product Development at PATH.
This is a really important scientific and regulatory milestone because it confirms that it's biologically and technically feasible to make a malaria vaccine that has a favorable benefit-risk profile. So what this means is we now have a new tool to combat this very wily parasite.
And so this thing is geared toward children, right?
Yes. And so the focus of this vaccine development effort has really been on children because that's where the biggest disease burden is. In particular, children living in sub-Saharan Africa.
Why is it that it's happening there so much?
I think, you know, part of it has to do with the environment there. A lot of it has to do with the mosquitoes that transmit this disease. Some of it has to do with the socioeconomic situation that currently exists in Africa. Malaria used to be a problem in the United States, but with good housing and good control of standing water, et cetera, we were able to actually eliminate malaria from the United States.
Now, you mentioned some numbers, like 2 million people affected every year, 500,000 killed. What is this thing doing?
Actually, it's almost 200 million cases each year, over 584,000 deaths estimated each year, and 90% of those are in Africa. And it's a wily parasite. It's learned how to evolve along with humans to continue to cause disease and death.
So this is a pretty exciting development, this vaccine, but some say it's only 30% effective and the efficacy wanes over time. Why put something out that's only 30% effective?
Efficacy and the effect of a vaccine is critically important, but equally as important is the public health impact. How many cases are averted by using this vaccine? The public health benefit is huge in those lower resource settings because of the disease burden. Slightly more than 980 clinical malaria cases are averted in infants per 1,000 infants vaccinated over a 38-month period of follow-up.
So GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of this new vaccine, claims that the drug will be affordable. In fact, they say they're not going to make any money on it. Do you trust them?
GSK has been, you know, a trusted partner in the development of RTSS now for more than a decade. Actually, they've been working on this vaccine for almost 30 years, and they've been very consistent and committed to making this vaccine available at a not-for-profit price if it's approved. And what they said is they'll make it available at the cost of manufacturing plus a small return of around 5%. And they've gone on to say that that return would be reinvested in research and development for a next generation or second generation malaria vaccine or other neglected tropical diseases.
David, what has taken so long? 30 years to produce a vaccine. Why?
So this is not, you know, a small little virus or a bacteria. We're talking about a wily parasite that has a very complex genome structure and has figured out ways of evading and evolving in humans to be really tough to get rid of.
David Caslow is Vice President of PATH. That's a nonprofit international organization focused on health care for women and children in low resource settings. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.
Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump was in Laredo, Texas for just a couple of hours yesterday, but the dust hasn't settled yet. Trump traveled to the border city to, surprise, denounce illegal immigrants crossing from Mexico, the same ones he accused earlier of being rapists, drug traffickers, and just plain bad for America. Yesterday, the Donald professed his love for Hispanics who are here legally. They make great workers, he noted, and he predicted that Latinos would love him back. Trump's statements have outraged many in the U.S., but how are they going down in Mexico? Paola Villarreal is a Mexican blogger who's currently in Boston. And Paola, what kind of reactions are you hearing from people back home?
Well, there's a lot of outrage, obviously, but my friends tell me that they're starting to think that he's really a clown.
He's a clown?
Yeah.
Don't they kind of like that tough guy approach to solving problems?
They do, but unfortunately, Donald Trump is looking more like a clown than a tough guy. Mm. For them, it's very funny on how he's trying to be a tough guy, but ended up being booed and, you know, made fun of with memes and all that. So,
ooh, what are some of the memes?
Well, they're comparing him to the Simpsons grandpa, like when
to the grandpa in the Simpsons,
Things like that, and making fun of his hair, you know.
Okay, so you're saying they're treating it as kind of a joke in Mexico, but you know, some of the stuff that he says is actually quite offensive. Is there any outrage there at all?
Yeah, it is. It is. The sad part of this is that he is like actually his words have impact. Right. And a lot of people listen to him, unfortunately. And yeah, the outrage is that, like, in the political class, and politicians are very angry at him because he's denying rights of Mexicans in the United States. And he is trying to connect with a conservative audience using this kind of hate and this kind of hateful speech.
He makes a big distinction between documented and undocumented Mexicans in the United States, legal and illegal, I guess you'd say. Do Mexicans make that distinction?
We don't. I mean, for many Mexicans, there's no distinction. It's like we all, well, many of us want to come here to work and do something good for Mexico and the United States, because at the end of the day, we are neighbors, right? So we don't see it as a big difference if you are illegal or legal or whatever you want to say. But he's actually speaking about Mexicans in general, which is also insulting.
There's a big discussion in the United States right now, especially among journalists, over how to deal with Donald Trump, whether we deal with Donald Trump. But the fact is that he is getting a lot of traction with regular people in America right now. I wonder, you know, as much as you say he's looked at as a clown, you know, what he's talking about, the way he's talking about it, and the reaction that he's getting is very real.
Yeah, I know. I'm wondering, like, someone told him that his target audience was ignorant or full of prejudices, and he believed that, right? So I think it's time for Americans to prove him wrong, that Americans are not neither ignorant nor full of prejudice, right? So it's time for people to say no to Donald Trump and to stop giving him this kind of attention that we are also giving him right now, right? So,
Mexican blogger Paula Villarreal, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Turkey joins the fight against ISIS. That story and lots more coming up on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. The way women speak is like a hot topic right now. There's upspeak, vocal fry, and that word like.
All of these things are sort of being pointed out as tics of speech that women need to watch out for if they want to be taken more seriously.
But is the problem really the listener and not the speaker? Find out ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Turkey has finally had it with the so-called Islamic State. Turkish warplanes have, for the first time, launched airstrikes against ISIS targets across the border in Syria. This is big because Turkey had so far been reluctant to combat the militants directly. We often speak here on the show with reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul. Today I asked her to explain why Turkey has waited so long to go after ISIS.
Turkey hasn't actually been directly attacked by ISIS in all of this time. And so Turkey has had this sort of fine balance that it's been trying to strike, where it doesn't want to sort of stoke the fire and make itself more susceptible to attack. It's extremely vulnerable with its long border with Syria and with so many ISIS militants nearby. But basically what happened yesterday was that there was a skirmish along the border where ISIS shot in and killed one Turkish soldier, a border patrol. And so Turkey fought back, reportedly killing one ISIS militant, and then overnight had launched its first ever airstrikes from Turkish airspace into Syria, reportedly killing about 35 ISIS militants.
Is there talk there in Turkey of escalating it beyond that, of actually crossing the border?
Not right now. There have been a few conversations about issuing a no-fly zone and sort of trying to make a buffer zone to keep Turkey safer. But there isn't any conversation right now. Turkey has stepped up its cooperation with the U.S.-led coalition, allowing the U.S. to use the air base in Turkey, the Incirlik Air Base, which is usually used by NATO. And that is actually a huge move because it's been several months of negotiations where the U.S. has been trying to convince Turkey to allow them to use this airbase.
And why didn't that happen before? Do we know?
Well, reports from government officials, both from Prime Minister Davutoğlu and President Erdogan, have said they've come up with an agreement with the U.S. that address Ankara's concern, but they haven't revealed details as to what these concerns are.
Now, earlier this week, a group of young activists were killed in a suicide bombing attack in Suruç in southern Turkey, and that is being blamed on ISIS. Do we have any further word on who was behind this? Has anyone accepted responsibility?
No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but police officials have said that the individual that they've identified seems to have some links with ISIS. Him and his brother have been missing for a good while. His family has reported him missing. There's been a very unclear history of where this man has been. But ISIS has not claimed responsibility for the attack, nor has anyone else. And so the details regarding this are very, very unclear.
But it certainly seems like the Turkish government is blaming ISIS, right? That they've stepped up a crackdown on people who have connections with that militant group, ISIS, and others.
That's absolutely true. This morning, a raid of hundreds of homes across Turkey resulted in the detention of over 200 people linked to, or officials say that they're linked to, ISIS and other militant groups, other terror organizations, both within Turkey and beyond its borders. So they've definitely cracked down on militant activities. And in terms of the Suruç bombing, the government officials have said that they believe that an individual linked to ISIS carried it out.
Now, Dalia, you spent some time with some of the friends and colleagues of the group of people who were killed on Monday. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I visited the office, the Istanbul office of the Federation of Youth Socialist Associations. And that's the group that had sent a delegation of about 350 people down to Kobani to help rebuild it. And they're a group of young people, leftists, with very strong leftist ideals, believing in equality in every way. And they're really devastated. They said that they were prepared for anything when they had gone to Kobani, but the way this attack was carried out was not something that they could have ever imagined.
Okay, Dalia Murtada in Istanbul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's have a listen to your story.
The SGDF office in central Istanbul is small and cramped, with Marxist books on the shelves. A poster for May Day protests for workers' rights hangs in the main room. Next to that, a series of flyers encouraging people to join the mission to help rebuild the Syrian Kurdish town of Kobani. SGDF rounded up about 350 people to go. 31 of them were killed at a bombing of their press conference en route. Özgür Bedeli has been involved in the group for several years, and he says that while no one could have seen anything like this coming, it's not the first time they've faced violence. We're always facing attacks, Özgür says. He's talking about other demos that SGDF has been involved in, like the Gezi Park protests of 2013. And the attacks are what he and other activists describe as excessive police force. Water cannons, rubber bullets, and shooting tear gas canisters as projectiles. Özgür is 22, skinny, with a scruffy beard and a mustache. He says he joined SGDF because of his passion for equality, especially the Kurdish cause for autonomy and rights.
Bizim çağrıda bulunduğumuz, özellikle genç kitle, bizim çağrıda bulunduğumuz genel kitledir.
Özgür says their main goal is to encourage young people to take to the streets. SGDF is the youth movement of a militant socialist party. The group's mission to Kobani was unusual, says another member, Derya Barış, because they weren't protesting. They were there to help rebuild. So the bombing, which occurred on the Turkish side of the border, came as an absolute shock. Derya says they still can't make sense of it.
Actually, there is no word to say anything I think there is something in my throat and it prevents my breath.
2 days after the attack, a Turkish court order banned media coverage of the bombings and shut down any website with video and photos from the attacks. The remaining members of SGDF are trying to collect any images they can find. While many in Turkey blame ISIS for the bombings, no one has claimed responsibility. And SGDF members don't trust the government and its gag order.
They want to prevent mass protests. And of course, there is one thing to add. They are want to cover it up, the truth, for example, the real suicide bomber.
But for now, Özgür says, they need to focus on healing.
Şimdi temel yaptığımız yaralarımızı sarmak, temel yapacaklarımız yaralarımızı sarmak.
Our first mission right now is to care for our wounded, Özgür explains. But after that, we're not going to abandon Kobani. We're going to continue, he says. For the world, I'm Dalia Mortara in Istanbul.
This is not a good time for Christians in the Middle East, and that's especially true in Syria and Iraq. Some of the oldest Christian communities on earth in those two countries are facing an existential threat. The murderous rampage of ISIS and other violent extremist groups are driving Christians out of their homes, and there's no one putting a stop to it. Eliza Griswold has been writing about the fault lines between Christianity and Islam. She's the author of The Tenth Parallel. And she's got a new story in the New York Times Magazine that asks, is this the end of Christianity in the Middle East? So, Eliza, what's the short answer to that question?
The short answer is it's complicated. And we're certainly looking at the potential end of Christianity in the Middle East if no one does anything to protect these ancient communities that are dwindling now.
Remind us who we're talking about when we talk about Middle East Christians.
That's an excellent question. So we're not just talking about a religious identity. We're talking about an ancient ethnic and even national identity that's, in some cases, thousands of years old.
And what different sects or denominations are we talking about?
In Iraq, most of the dwindling populations of Christians, most Christians are Catholic. They belong to different groups within the Catholic Church, different churches. After that comes Orthodox, and within the Orthodox community, there are further splits between Eastern and Oriental Orthodox, and then there is the Assyrian Church of the East, which is neither Orthodox nor Catholic and conducts its liturgy in the language Jesus spoke in Aramaic.
I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question, but considering the fact that Christians in the Middle East do have such little clout at the moment, why do ISIS and other groups go after them? Why not just, let them live their lives separate from, what in that region is a Sunni majority?
ISIS and other groups go after Christians as they go after other religious and ethnic minorities. In larger numbers, they go after the Yazidis. They go after the Kaka'i. They go after the Shia Turkmen. They go after anybody who's going to challenge them. So the Christians are one of this larger group at the same time. And you can see this in ISIS's videos, a couple of really chilling videos this spring about the status of Christians living within the Islamic State territory. ISIS and its ilk sees Christians as tied to the West, and they become the easiest scapegoat and easiest target when the West is out of reach. So it's these two things. It's A, that Christians are suffering like many other minorities in the Middle East, and that's essential to understand. At the same time, Christians represent the seeming tie to the West for extremists, and so they are, in this case, an additional target.
Even though ISIS knows perfectly well that there is no real connection.
That's exactly right. I mean, ISIS functions by propaganda. And largely what they're doing with Christians, as certainly they're doing with Yazidis and others, they're robbing them, right? So when they come in and under ISIS propaganda, it is legitimate. If a Christian does not convert to Islam, it is legitimate to make them pay a tax, to enslave them, to kill the men and to seize the women and children as war booty and to seize their money. So a lot of this is a way to legitimize robbery as well.
Now, Eliza, Lebanon is one place where Christians have a history and actually some political clout, right?
Yeah.
And many Christians from Syria and Iraq have fled there. How well is Lebanon dealing with the influx of war refugees? And is the Christian community there able to, I don't know, help the problem in any way?
So Lebanon is under an incredible amount of pressure, with 1.5 million refugees having come from the civil war in Syria. That is a substantial amount of the Lebanese population. So they're groaning under the weight of this larger refugee population. And within that larger population, what's happened most recently, starting the spring really, as ISIS began to target Christians in northeastern Syria, we saw this new influx of Christians, of Syrian Christians. So the church is principally responsible for them in Beirut, and the Assyrian Church of the East, which is really looking after many of them, is absolutely flattened by their presence. They can't afford to care for them at all. When I was there, I spoke to one assistant bishop who was principally bartering to get bodies of refugees who died in hospitals, to get the bodies out of the hospitals, because the refugees couldn't pay the hospital bills. And so the Lebanese hospitals were holding on to these bodies, saying, we're not releasing this person until you pay the bill. And the bishop was having these fights with the hospital, saying things like, you know, I am morally and religiously absolved of that body. You do with whatever you want in that morgue, but we're not paying this bill. So it was really heartbreaking to watch a community that had fled Syria in order to survive, dying and facing a huge amount of pressure in Lebanon as well.
Now, you went to visit Christian communities, what's left of them, in northern Iraq. And we're starting to hear about Christian militias forming there and Christian groups being trained by foreign fighters, including Americans. Do you have any hope that the communities will be maintained in Iraq?
When we look at people displaced by ISIS, and we look at Iraq alone, we're looking at 3 million people. 85% of those people are Sunni Muslims. And that's essential to say, to understand who we're seeing displaced. Of those who are not Sunni Muslims, many of them belong to religious minorities. And one of those minorities is this Christian community. So how they are surviving now, they live in refugee camps. They rent apartments with kind of 5 families in an apartment. They survive at the margins of northern Iraq. What they want is to be able to return to the Nineveh Plain, which is one of their ancient homelands.
And that's around Mosul.
Exactly right. Mosul is the biggest, Mosul being Iraq's second largest city, is really the biggest city on the Nineveh Plain. And the Nineveh Plain is a breadbasket for Iraq. Okay, so they want to go back to the Nineveh Plain. And right now, that's impossible because ISIS is there. But the Nineveh Plain has also long been a contested region between the Arabs and the Kurds. So it's fraught. What they'd like is the right to be their own region in the Nineveh Plain. And that would require a budget and the right to self-defense. So what they're looking for under the Iraqi constitution, and provisions exist already for this, is to say, okay, we have the right to defend ourselves and we have the right to a budget that will allow us to fix our own roads. That's the extent of what the international community is going to support. Nobody's going to create a no-fly zone for these guys. Nobody's going to put international troops on the ground. But if there is the means to create the framework within the Iraqi constitution itself, then there is hope of this community remaining in Iraq.
Eliza Griswold has a big story in the New York Times Magazine this week about Christians in the Middle East. She joined us from San Francisco. We're always looking to hear from you. Add your thoughts about any of our stories on our Facebook page. Find us at facebook.com/PRI the world. And be sure to get the latest from our newsroom on Twitter. We are at PRI the world. And if you dare, see what I'm tweeting about. It's more than just cute cats. I'm at World Aaron, and you're listening to The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis, americangraduate.org, and by Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills at curious.com/PRI.
I'm Aaron Schachter with The World. Lots of advice out there recently on how American women should speak if they want to be taken seriously, especially young women. But actually, what's so wrong with the way women speak? And is it just American women getting this unsolicited advice? One of our interns here at The World put those questions to linguists around the globe.
Hi, my name is Maura Lavelle, and currently I am working very hard not to say or like. Lately, Anne Friedman has been getting a lot of criticism for just that. Friedman is a freelance journalist, and she has a podcast called Call Your Girlfriend. She and her co-host have been told more than once they were unlistenable because they say like and too frequently. In response, she wrote a column called Can We Just, Like, Get Over the Way Women Talk?
All of these things are sort of being pointed out as tics of speech that are particular to women and are things that women need to watch out for if they need to be or want to be taken more seriously.
It's not just the word like. Women have been critiqued for apologizing too frequently, for vocal fry, that thing where you hold out your vowels in the back of your throat, for uptalk, when you end every sentence like a question, and a host of other vocal tics that are seen as especially female. But Americans are not alone in the conviction that women speak differently.
In Spain, for instance, the speech of middle-upper-class women is characterized by adding diminutive suffixes. In Spanish, they would be ito, ita, or illa, ico to everything.
That's linguistic anthropologist Inma Garcia Sanchez, who works in Spain. Anthropologist Mary Good researches young women's speech patterns in the islands of Tonga, South Pacific. And she says there's a stereotype there about the way young women talk.
People tend to say that young women gossip more than young men. I don't know that it's necessarily true, but it's one of the things that older people talk about in young people's speech.
You can find this stuff everywhere. If you watch a Tanzanian beauty pageant, you'll see that women are judged partly on the purity of their language. They're supposed to speak only Swahili or only English because mixing the two is considered less feminine. Or, if you speak Japanese, there are polite and non-polite forms for basically every single verb. Today, young women are dropping these polite forms, so there's the sense that younger women are rude. But do women really speak all that differently, or is it just a stereotype? I asked communications professor Sherry Bowen.
I think another important thing to look at when you're considering differences in language and ways of speaking for men and for women is to back up and say, how are we valuing those different ways of speaking if they do really exist?
Because it's clear that younger American men have some of the same tics. They have vocal fry. They say like and you know. Spanish men use diminutives. Japanese men drop polite verb forms. Men and women do not speak all that differently. Mostly, it's that the way women talk is seen as lesser, says Robin Lakoff, a linguist who pioneered the study of language and gender.
Every language that we've looked at, there are things that are identified as what men do and are identified as what women do. And usually, more often than not, certainly, the things that are identified as what women do are the ones that people look down on and call bad ways of talking, whatever they are.
So Anne Friedman, for one, is ready for us to just get over it.
If someone doesn't take you seriously, it is probably their own perceptions of you as a woman or of speech patterns they associate with women. And I think like those are big entrenched problems that we don't solve by saying, stop saying like.
With all that in mind, I'm like not that concerned about the way I talk. For The World, I'm Maura Lavelle.
Finally today, how about a little Ethiopian music in honor of President Obama's visit to Ethiopia this weekend?
Shugia, shugia, come, 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 shugia.
That's singer-songwriter Maclete Hadero. She came from Ethiopia to the U.S., Iowa to be exact, when she was just 2 years old. She spoke to me earlier from San Francisco, where she lives now.
We left in the early 80s when the country was still feeling the aftermath of the 1974 revolution. And it was a time of political turmoil and a lot of violence. And my dad had a college professor in Iowa, and we pretty much didn't know anyone else in the country. And he said, come on out and live with us. So we went out there and were there for 4 years and then hopped on over to Brooklyn, where I did most of my childhood growing up.
So how long was it before you went back to Ethiopia? And I wonder what preconceived notions you had of what the country would be like.
Well, I didn't go back to Ethiopia until I was 21, and I went on a trip. It was just me and my mom. And I think that I wouldn't call it preconceived notions so much, but what I would call it was the filter of my parents' lives and experiences.
Hmm.
There was this moment with my mother, and the two of us were having this conversation with one of my cousins. And up until that moment, my mother had always talked about Ethiopia as back home. You know, growing up, when she would want to refer to Ethiopia, she almost never would say its name. She would say back home. But then in that moment, she was telling a story and spoke about the United States as back home. And she caught herself.
Wow.
And it was like this moment of stopping. And what I realized then is that a home is always in flux.
What do you think of President Obama's visit to one of your home countries? Have you had any conversations among friends in Ethiopia or Ethiopian Americans about him going there?
So I think there are some pretty mixed feelings about Obama's visit to Ethiopia. I mean, it's the first time a sitting president has gone to Ethiopia. It's the first time a sitting president is talking to the African Union, which is kind of crazy. There are a lot of mixed feelings, but I think at the heart, people are just hoping that he talks about more than investment. People are hoping that he talks about human rights and governance. And for me, I think President Obama is in this very interesting place because he's sort of full of surprises these days. You know, there's the Iran nuclear deal, there's opening relations with Cuba, he's talking about race and racism in a totally different way. He's talking about prison reform. I think for me, I don't know what will come from this trip. I think Obama has a lot of space to surprise us.
In times I never had enough, a hole in what I needed.
Ethiopian American singer Mekleet Hadero. She spoke to us from San Francisco. You can read and hear a lot more from her at PRI.org. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Marco Werman is back on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH. Brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org, by the Ford Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.